So I'd like to start, or rather, we've already started. Mm-hmm. I have a question about labor history, because one of your areas of specialization is talking about labor history, and you've also written a fair bit about class, and more recently you've written about how class has kind of fallen out as a frame of thinking about a framework for thinking about politics and mm-hmm. The transformation that's taking place in Poland. Could you talk a bit about how you came to be interested in labor history in particular, and how you see class as operating in the political realm in East Central Europe?
Well, I kind of grew up, both because of the time, born in 1955, and my parents were part of that old left, so, thinking about class, or just that term, was always kind of prominent. There was always that clash between the old left and the new left, as the new left certainly had less emphasis on class, although there were always sections of that new left that saw themselves connected very much to class, whether it was people who went off to be workers or so I was always sympathetic and kind of grew up with that kind of interest. Now then, what happened is that studying Eastern Europe and studying Poland and even Solidarity in particular, class seemed less central. And in my first book, I probably don't use the term at all, right? And I think that for communist society, it didn't make much sense. It wasn't a really salient cleavage, and it didn't impact, classes, groups in civil society didn't struggle with each other. They were all organized against the state, right? So the state as the owner of all, as the employer of all, as the distributor and redistributor, was the other for all social groups, right? So I wasn't aware, I think, when I wrote that first book, I didn't think so much about that class is not really significant in the communist era period. But it was only afterwards that became quite clear, right? After 90, 91, 92. Right around the time my first book came out, there were two other books. First, Roman Laba's book came out on Roots of Solidarity. It was focused on the workers' movement per se. And then Lawrence Goodwin's book came out a few years later, Breaking the Barriers, I think is the title, right? So also focusing on that. And so, soon after my first book came out, I felt that, I kind of did neglect that. And I was trying to understand why I had so. I think it made sense for understanding the theory of democracy, as I was mentioning last time. That was my central issue for the first book. But when I came back to Poland in 1992, I hadn't been there between 90 and 92, and of course so much was happening then, and came back in 92 and then was there regularly over the 90s, then I saw, class emerge as such a obvious cleavage, an obvious issue, right? I mean, because you had people... You now had openings to a new type of middle class, of course not employed by the state, so groups accumulating property. The official rhetoric was, we're building a system in the name of a class that doesn't exist. That was kind of the extent of use, the kind of playful, ironic understanding of class. But it was clear also that those who were, working in those old factories, and particularly the unskilled or the somewhat skilled as opposed to the professionals or the engineers in those factories, because everyone was in those factories in the communist era, but that all is breaking apart in 92, right? The professionals are exiting, the unskilled are the first to be marginalized, right? Early retirement or pushed out, you know, they keep some of the skilled workers, some of the skilled workers get to go to some private firms, you know, so you see all of this differentiation now without the state being an arbiter or distributor. So it was like, wow, you know, this is shaping politics, shaping views about politics, about party support, about, you know, what we believe in, what we're sporting, what kind of system is going to emerge. So I began from 92 on just going to a lot of factory towns, small and medium-sized cities that had been heavily industrialized, as so much of the country was. I didn't go much to the, you know, collective farm areas, but those areas in Silesia are in the old central industrial district that's now eastern Poland. You know, you have these pockets of very highly developed towns. So that began being central. Then you asked another part of that.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of answered it about your the way that you're thinking about classes changed over time. But I was wondering if you noted that there's something peculiar about maybe the East Bloc and the Soviet Union included here, is that in some respects there was a classless society, or would you...
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that Milovan Gilas argues is that in his work, The New Classes, that he talks about how communism creates a kind of aristocracy of its own, or that communism in Yugoslavia, the way he talks about it, that it created its own aristocracy. Do you see, I mean, if you look at it now, is it truly classless? Or
no, now, of course, far from it. I mean,
if
you look at the communist period.
Yeah.
Look, there are inequalities. I guess it's, you know, how we understand class. I mean, if class distinctions as opposed to right status distinctions, or as opposed to world type of feudal type distinctions. In communist society, we could see that there's a group connected to political power that has privileges for itself, can't naturally pass on its privileges, right? Because it doesn't have any independent source of wealth. It doesn't have any... During communist society, it had no capital that could be used apart from party apart from political connections. Right, even education, even some money, all those things one might have accumulated, right, you could lose that. Now, of course, during late communist times, from the 60s, from the 70s on, there was not many purges. These are stable communist systems, and you do see more reproduction of that elite, particularly in terms of educational capital, right, the kinds of things that are going to be important after 1989. So, you know, I don't think that the concept class helps us understand communist society still. I talk about, you know, other types of inequalities. And, you know, Szalai in his book, right now what's the exact terms he uses for it? Almost all of his books, but the one with Eyal and Hopkins is her name? I forget. But Capitalism Without Capitalists, right, in which he's writing about different types of society, and also doesn't see class as a central cleavage during the communist period, and also to see, like I said a moment ago, the way that all social groups are pitted against the political authorities, right, and can unite easily, and their interests were all pitted against the authorities, against the state, rather than against each other, right? Managers never had a problem with workers' demands because managers didn't pay wages, right? That came from a wage bill, so you needed something from the state. You know, in the initial post-communist period, you saw a lot of state-owned managers working together with state workers, right, to try to get more from the state, right? Those kind of alliances made sense. They were losing out. They were losing their sense, and that's what was emerging in the 1990s. So, I don't think I still think I'm right for not focusing on class in the first book, and and right for seeing its emerging centrality. Particularly in terms of political understandings in the post-communist period.
I wonder if it's possible that there's something peculiarly Polish about this story of class or its periodic emergence. I was thinking of some of the writings after the partitions of Poland, where there was a lot of kind of argument. I can't remember if it's Lalewski or thank you. He writes, for example, that we have to unite kind of across, you know, that we all have to be Poles now.
Right.
We can't afford to be, you know, aristocrat, peasant, etc. That we have to kind of recognize that there's something called Poland that needs to organize as such. And this didn't make class go away. It made it be not important.
Right.
And I'm wondering if it's possible. I mean, because it's very strange to think of Poland as a classless society. It's in East Central Europe, it's one of the least historically classless societies. If you compare it to places like Czechoslovakia or the Czech lands, or places that have historical peasant majorities.
Well, it's similar to Hungary in this respect,
yes,
right?
With in a very the sense strong, an old state with a strong aristocracy.
Right, strong aristocracy.
An aristocracy that maintains its power well into the 20th century, and that maintains a kind of hold on politics as well. I was wondering if, you know, what we saw with Solidarity might have been something more like what one sees after the partitions, where it's not that there are no classes, it's that there is a precedent for subordinating class for this unity against economy.
I mean, I think during the communist period, almost all protest movements, particularly after 68 or after 70, are organized, kind of consciously organized with all different groups participating. But, you know, but during the communist period, you had, that old aristocracy really was, much of it is pauperized, and of course it had been pauperized beforehand as well. But, you know, they lose even more. I mean, much of it is taken over first by the Nazis, right, or by the Soviets, right, and then by People's Poland, as they called themselves. You know, so there would be some people with who could remember and knew for themselves they had some kind of title. But, during the communist period, that just didn't bring with it any special cachet, right? They weren't overly located in the party. The party, particularly in the 70s, had a lot of, the new people. In Russian it's called vidvizhentsi. I mean, those who had moved up during the communist period.
What about after communism? I mean, who are the people who became, there something historical to who became low and who became high in the new class hierarchy? Or was it just really a new, you know, that people who had formerly been, you know, workers within the system could now be aristocratic.
Getting back to that aristocratic, or starting with that old aristocratic issue, that's something that is kind of didn't happen right away because Poland has still never had a strict rule on reprivatization, as they might call it, right? It hasn't given back all this property to, inheritors or descendants of old aristocracy. Over time, in certain areas, certain people have won this over court cases, and I don't actually know all the ways in which certain people get it. That's something that's been talked about a little more lately. The current president, Komorowski, right, is the first. He has some old aristocratic title, and around that time there was stories about others who had regained certain kind of property. But most of the lands they held were in areas that are now, right, Ukraine and Lithuania, right? So all of that land was lost. They didn't have any, of course, in Western Poland. Those who became dominant in the initial post-communist period at first, it's a kind of what might call a comprador bourgeoisie, right? Those who are working for foreigners, right? Foreign corporations come there, and a lot of people who were young and knew foreign languages, kind of young intellectuals and students, right in 89, had good mobility. A lot of the engineers and professionals working in the factories left to start their own private firms. Some of that is what they call the old, communist nomenklatura. Most of those had been had gotten expertise in a certain area from working in that area during the communist period. So a lot of them became kind of new emerging capitalists, right? You didn't have the same kind of oligarchization, whatever the term is, right, as you did in Russia or Ukraine. You know, partly you don't have that massive supply of resources, right, of the oil wealth like that, but also, you had state policy that encouraged this privatization with the workforce expressing certain, they had a say in it. So you see, some old communists, old dissidents, right, also emerging into the civil society, public sphere, into the media, right? They became very dominant, obviously, the Gazeta Wyborcza crowd. But plenty of others in small towns. Again, when I did my research in the early 90s in these small cities, almost everywhere there'd be either a chamber of commerce or a small local newspaper that is started partly by people who are, solidarity activists and, minor intellectuals or professionals. Some of them had gone on to be, right, working for various new state agencies that are created, right, because they needed to put in place new, reliable people. There were changes in the managerial boards. A very widespread co-optation of former activists onto managerial boards, right? Many of whom have now become, stay on as private managers. And you get this differentiation among the working class, which I talk about in my book, where the unskilled, because communist factories almost everywhere except Yugoslavia was slightly different because unemployment started earlier, but everywhere you had this massive employment, including many people who weren't. Whose labor wasn't necessary for factory production, but the firm was a social welfare agency, and the communist era, so that all stopped, and they were pushed out first, and skilled workers, most of them stayed on, except if you were, you know, over 55. A lot of them were on early retirement or just didn't, you know, live long enough really, or to get, or you know, professionally. Some of them got jobs in some of the new private firms, but a lot of them exited out.
One thing that you mentioned, I think it's a still unpublished article, if I remember correctly, about class. And at the end of the article, you talk about the next generation's kind of...
The one I sent you?
Yes.
You know, that was published in Journal of New School Journal, International Journal of... Now I forget the title, but...
Okay, yeah, maybe I just have a proof version. But one thing that struck me about that article is that you talk about the renewed interest in class on the part of the younger generation. And this is something that Marcy Shore has observed in the reception of her book, and you were talking about in the reception of your book on Defeat of Solidarity. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how you explain, is it that the younger generation, what is it looking for, and why does it look in particular places?
Well, you know, even in the 90s, it seemed to me that this sense of classlessness and this objection to thinking in terms of class was pretty widespread, you know, as a reaction to the communist system and, you know, the peculiar type of anti-communism they had there based on civil society, based on unity, also, you know, saw classes as just not central, not important, right? But it always seemed to me that this is a short-term phenomenon as a new generation emerges, and you know, I think that's been key. I started seeing already in 2000 is the first time I saw some renewed interest in this. First in Poland, you have the Krytyka Polityczna group. That's still around, and you know, was this kind of new post-communist left, you know, very, very intellectual oriented, but also started seeing some renewed interest in building trade unions, right, on the part of young people, which was completely absent in the 1990s. By no means is this a massive phenomenon, right, but it certainly increases. So you have a new generation that doesn't, right, that didn't experience the past, that didn't experience any thinking in terms of class, but also find, you know, a very precarious conditions of work, you know, that find that there's no real protection for themselves. Also, by the 2000s, you have massive emigration, and a lot of people come back. So there's a whole lot of people, particularly working in England, where, you know, unions are still important there. Mm-hmm. You know, I've met several people who come back to Poland who learned about unions and unionism in England, right, and come back to Poland and bring this interest there. You know, on the part of younger intellectuals, there's a kind of natural interest, part of rejoining Europe. Well, attack, right? The French movement attack. This anti-globalization was very big in the O's. Right, I see a lot of young intellectuals connecting with that, as a lot of them learned Western social science. I mean, in the 90s, I taught a course that seemed so central for young intellectuals in Eastern Europe. I taught at Central European University, right? This course wasn't, not at first, but after I taught, after a couple of years, a course was called Western Marxism, Western Social Science, right? Because you had all these young anti-communists, young Democrats who were learning about Western social science and, you know, didn't understand what's this talk of Marxism. Oh, we know Marxism. And yet they found, gee, but there are interesting critiques going on and interesting analyses. And maybe Marxism is not just, you know, Brezhnevism, whatever that is, right? That there's something more to learn. You know, so I see that kind of that kind of interest as more natural. And even, you know, today it's increasingly so.
Maybe I'm glad you mentioned the teaching at CEU, because you've also taught at Wrocław,
yeah.
Right? And perhaps you could talk a bit about your experiences teaching in East Central Europe and what kinds of changes you've witnessed over the years in terms of what the students are up to, or maybe even reflecting on institutional changes. I mean, CEU is a relatively new institution. There used to be a branch in Warsaw, right?
Right. Sociology was in Warsaw, maybe something else, but then after about 2000, they moved to Budapest.
Yeah, there used to be one in Prague as well, and
right.
Now it's exclusively
in
Budapest. Yeah. And so, you know, a lot of things have changed in terms of academic opportunities for people of the region. The demographics of CU itself have changed quite radically. The people who go there. And so, what have you personally witnessed, and what has been your kind of classroom and experience?
Now I'm not sure when the first time I taught there was. I can probably check my own CV, but maybe 94, 95. Certainly 96 at the latest, and then I taught for a year at CEU, 98, 99, but I'd done a little bit beforehand. In the early 90s at CEU and a lot and other places like in Poland where there was support mostly from Soros for students studying in English elsewhere, but in Eastern Europe, you had just spectacular students, right? You had some of the best from the Soviet bloc, and it was hard pickings. I remember '98 when I was employed at CEU. Then I went to Bulgaria and Romania. Everyone went to interview students, prospective students, and it was very hard selecting, right? They were all really superb, right? And so in the classroom, you had really superb students. At the very beginning, you had those who wanted to be in business as well as those who wanted to be intellectuals, right? So it's like anyone trying to get out and find some kind of education that would propel them forward. So, you know, they're all very talented, but you saw some difference between those who were, you know, felt encumbered by the classroom and social science thinking, you know, and more wanted to take something and go and build something with it and, you know, be important back home, as many of them went on to do. You know, by, I guess, already a bit in the later 90s, there seemed to be more opportunities for those who were more focused on business alone, either some other business schools that they might have gone to, but I haven't taught at those, particularly in the former Soviet Union, or Russians had a chance within Russia then to start business or to, you know, be connected with the emerging stock market in the mid to late 90s, right? So a number of them went back there and became influential in building their capital markets, right? So you started seeing less of them at CEU, and you got more people who were, focused on being academics, right? A number of them have gone on to various Western universities in the UK and US in particular, right, for PhDs. In recent times, like teaching there in recent years, like I taught a few years ago at Warsaw University, at this school, there's Jerzy Akser is one of those who try to create a liberal arts college from within Warsaw University. So a kind of special group where they have small classes, usually in English. But in any case, some are in English, and so they wanted me to teach in English there. With small groups of students, and that's I teach at a liberal arts college here, and that was similar to that, at least as far as the students, small classes, intensive work. Then I taught the last couple of years in Wrocław at one of these at the most successful private university technically called the Higher School of Social Psychology in Polish, but since they've been successful, they translate that into English. The official translation of that is the Warsaw School of Humanities and Social Sciences.
Yeah.
You know, because they saw, you know, it's a brand, right? They have a brand in Poland under the name of the Higher School of Social Psychology. But it became successful. They brought a lot of, sociologists, political scientists in there. And they've created schools elsewhere. So I was in Wrocław, where they were hoping to start a sociology program and wanted me to come teach there. They hired me before they'd gotten the sociology group going. In fact, they haven't been able to get enough sociologists. So, but for a couple of years, I teach mostly psychology students and those who are there for marketing and journalism. Right? Psychology and marketing, I guess they sort of go together there. I'm not sure if they're two separate departments, but, you know, a lot of people want to work for PR or something afterwards, right? Mm-hmm. Those students are quite different, and a lot of the private education nowadays is very different. I mean, that school in Warsaw, I know people who teach there. I think you still get better students and better prepared. In Wrocław, in these newer areas, you get a lot of people who are, you know, paying a good bit of money and hoping and kind of expecting, well, I pay for this, I get a degree, that degree is going to translate into something. There are a few people who did good work, but the first time I gave an assignment there, I had about a 28% complete plagiarization rate, right? Like, unbelievable. Like, I mean, just word for word, right?
Oh,
I mean,
God.
You just type in a sentence and put it on Google and you'd find the source,
God.
Right? So it was just unbelievable, right? And when I did it again and even warned people about it, I, still had a few of those. I had some very good students, but for the most part, they didn't have a lot of motivation. I got some very fascinating work from them. Actually, this is kind of interesting. The best student work I've ever got, because I gave them a very concrete assignment to interview someone, preferably in their family or a friend of the family, someone who's like, over 60 years old, preferably, someone who'd worked for a good period of time in the communist period and in the post-communist period, to talk about work, the differences of work, why they got into this job, how the atmosphere of work changed, their effort, their remuneration, and then they just typed these up, and I have some, fascinating kind of oral histories, but when told to a family member, it's so much, people tell so much more to a family member that they want them to understand than they do to an anonymous interviewer like me and you, if we were to ask them, right?
So what kinds of things would you get in those?
Oh, well, I guess I was really struck by the extent to which, by the almost universal kind remembering of work during the communist period, right? Now, of course, obviously there's something connected with, when you're young, right? But a lot of these people still weren't that old, and they all told a very similar story, of just not having that rivalry that became almost universal afterwards, right? That they didn't fear this other person or new people, or who are these new people coming? Are they here to replace us? They're cutting back this job and the other job, so, we don't go out as much together. We don't do things together. We don't have that solidarity. We don't know what we're doing as much. We're not informed as well by, managers. Managers get more distant. This was fascinating, a couple of people who had small private firms during the communist period said life was much better back then. That they were able, right, if they were suppliers of something to a state firm, and maybe supplying, food for an outing or something, right, or, you know, some tourist possibilities. I mean, you know, the different kind of small firms existed. As a couple of them said, well, they always got paid on time by the state firms. And if not, one of them says, you know, some accountant from the firm comes over at Saturday morning with a handful of cash to pay me what they owe, right? And nowadays, it's like you, right, you extend credit, you have to, you know, send threatening letters. We just don't get paid. We don't know when we're going to get paid. You know, yeah, so that was kind of remarkable. It's something I'd like to write up, use that write up. But this term, I'm doing something similar in the U.S., so I might wait a bit and see what kind of stuff we get.
So on occasion, you've made contributions as what I would call a public intellectual.
Yeah.
You've written for Newsweek Polska, for The Nation, the Chicago Tribune, and by virtue of having published the book of Adam Michnik, I mean, you've also been in touch with public intellectuals.
Yeah.
And, you know, let's say, moving in public intellectual circles. How do you view that aspect of your career, and what is the role of the scholar in sort of public debate about contemporary issues, historical issues?
You know, I my interest in becoming an intellectual before I even knew what all these things meant or these terms meant, that was certainly all I had in mind was a public intellectual. Again, as I mentioned last time, you know, no one in my family who had higher education, you know, they had kind of incomplete higher education and nothing connected with graduate school, so I really didn't know that at all, right? My father was very well read, but probably should have been a school teacher, but school teaching paid very little, and he was active in union movement. He was active in the Communist Party in the U.S. until the Khrushchev revelations, at which point, right, he moved away and still stayed on the left. He was excited by the rise of the Euro-communists, you know, in the 90s. And growing up in New York as well, where I didn't even know that there was that, you know, what became to be known as the New York intellectuals, all of whom saw themselves as public intellectuals, right? So I thought that was the only kind there was. I went to graduate school, and there I'm meeting for the first time the serious academic stuff. Because in college, I mean, I did a lot of serious historical work, but it was the first time I wasn't trying to be a scholar, a professional scholar as an undergraduate. As a graduate, I realized that's what I'm being trained for, and I kind of rebelled against that, partly by taking courses in other departments, which I was allowed to do at that time, whether in economics, in philosophy, even, you know, comparative literature, a course on Romanticism, right? I remember, you know, all important, I was trying to understand critical theory, right? Kant to Hegel to Marx was a kind of central theme for a year or two in graduate school, the kind of thing that graduate student in political science today, Wisconsin and most other places, isn't going to be allowed to do, right? So, I mean, to me, that helped shape me, and when I went to Poland, I even wanted to go to Poland first to write articles about what was going on there right now, right? So I wrote a dozen or more articles for In These Times in 1981, 82, and a little bit afterwards as well, right? That's where I saw most of my work being done. As I mentioned last time, when I started writing my dissertation, it sort of came out like, well, you know, I'm writing too much journalism. You know, again, let's not have that discussion now. You know, I mean, journalism is not just, of course, putting down facts. I mean, I was always, you know, analyzing, like, this understanding this theory of democracy that is always informed by these intellectual questions about some kind of new ideas of democracy, right? Which I was interested in, like much of the new left, right? New that sees itself as democratic, but not Western style, just parliamentary, elitist democracy, and certainly not Soviet style, right? So we're looking for something else. So I saw, and I went to Poland to talk about those things emerging. Then I did find this hook, this corporatist hook, right, that kind of propelled me into more political science and sociology. But, I remember, I wasn't eager to be a professor when I was in graduate school, right? I didn't know what I was going to be. I still kind of thought, well, maybe there's some journalism. I mean, I didn't know. After I stayed in graduate school and got hooked and, just learning so much and exploring so much, I knew, I wanted to continue doing that. So I got this job here, and I was happy to have this job as a way of continuing to think about this. But, very, very seriously, in the first couple of years I was here, I was teaching, I still wasn't sure I wanted to continue doing it. I used to think about, now becoming a lawyer, right? A labor lawyer or immigration lawyer or something that would, again, I could be more actively involved in things. So, it's always been a kind of struggle for me in the political science field, having those kind of interests, right? I was also trained, I was about the last generation of those who could be trained in this kind of less positivistic and less statistical era, right? So, by the early 1990s, that's been, one of the things I'm well-respected as a historian, scholar of Eastern Europe, right, political scientist, understanding that, I don't have the quantitative skills or methodological skills that became very important in political science just in my early years of teaching, right? And so, for a while, I was wrestling with that within myself. I continue. I like the fact that my books, they've been praised for being well written, right? So this is a high praise for me. Again, some other scholars and some others might even treat that as not very respectable. That's maybe going too far, but there is something to that. So it's important to me to write in a language that's accessible, to still, I still rarely can motivate myself to write about things unless I think they have some, potential real importance, right, that they can be used, and I try to address it in those ways. So, stuff I'm writing now about class and about decline of class, right now I'm just finishing a review essay for Comparative Politics, of several books about labor and politics in the world, not concerning Eastern Europe. Actually, there hasn't been anything in the last few years focusing on that anyway, but, and I'm editing this special issue of EEPS, East European Politics and Society, on class and class analysis in post-communist countries, so gathering stories from 11, I think, post-communist countries, essays from those people who are writing about that. Recently, partly, the world has changed, right? That New York intellectual milieu, they died a while ago. New York City changed so radically. When I was there, I came back from graduate school. I came back from Poland in the fall, in December 1982, to work, and I was beginning to work on my dissertation. But I remember thinking then that, I wanted to be in New York, where there was still, I still thought that New York was a vital, vibrant, intellectual city. But, I didn't find it as such. I went back in 84 before I finished my dissertation. I remember even meeting some people, who were, I was talking about, right, solidarity. And I wanted to talk to people not because David Oates knew everything that was important, but because David Oates could bring back these incredible stories of what's going on in the world in Poland, which is such an exciting place and a way to think about again, political projects, right? Like the concept of civil society, which I worked on and others have picked up on, but there were other stories there too. You know, but I remember finding people who would say, oh, well, Solidarity, you know, that was last year, now we're on to something else. Or, you know, then in the 80s, New York City changed very much. This was the Reagan years, the time of the big boom in the stock market. You know, being a graduate student, I even had a visiting scholarship at Columbia University, right? I mean, I didn't go there that much, but I had affiliation. I was writing my dissertation. Being a graduate student pushing 30 without much money in New York in 1984, 85, I found made you a rather uncool person, you know? I mean, you were supposed to be on Wall Street at night and in the... You know, and in the pyramid, I mean, Wall Street in the day and the Pyramid Club at night or something. I mean, it was not a favorable intellectual world. I came back to Madison for a visit in late 85 and found it, oh, wow, this is a place where I can think again, where people are serious intellectuals, right? So, you know, maybe this is just me, but also growing up in New York, you know, that public intellectual world is not what it was. I mean, it already wasn't what it was when I was a kid, but I didn't know that. But now I don't do that as much. I wrote something recently for Dissent. You know, I haven't written for The Nation in a while. I may do so again soon. But I guess lately, you know, I've been writing, this book has had, the book has had... I guess in the United States, mostly, if not solely, academic interest, with few exceptions. In Poland, where it's translated, I mean, there it actually serves as a marker of a public intellectual, right? I mean, my name and these theses are very well known and continually cited in Poland, right? And not just by scholars, right? I mean, for scholars, it's helped legitimate talking about class, because they can talk about an American sociologist who does it, and, you know, it's a nice kind of reversal of this Western imperialist privilege, right, where, you know, broaching those ideas can no longer be denounced as something obscure, not having to do with serious, i.e. Western social science, you know, because I did it and published there, you know, and others too, but, you know, so there it serves that broader purpose. And I guess, you know, in Poland, I'm probably both a scholar, but, you know, in Poland, public intellectualism is much more highly developed than perhaps anywhere. I mean, that's going too far. I mean, what I've heard about Mexico is maybe something similar. You know, in the United States, yes, I'd like to be more of a public intellectual, but it's hard to say what that exactly means right now. You know, we could write a little more for The Nation, but, you know, they don't have much space, other than that, you know, I write occasionally, like I say, for Dissent. You know, yeah, probably if I lived in New York in a bigger market, right, I might have, especially in the early 90s when Eastern Europe was very big, you know, I expect I would have been called on much more, you know, to speak in a more public circuit, or, you know, media circuit, right, mainstream media circuit. But, you know, in any case, I mean, now the topics we work on are not mainstream media at all, right? Nothing's going on there that is of broad interest. So you know, I've wrestled with that. Now I'm doing it a little less, but I guess I don't feel I'm not totally at peace with that, right? So I still try to make the academic projects again both readable and important in a broader way, but. You know, I don't even know the outlets myself of what it takes to be or what a public intellectual would do today.
Maybe we could switch gears a bit, because I want to talk about institutions, and particularly about the transformation that's taking place in institutions around area studies. And this isn't probably as relevant at Hobart and Williams Smith, but it's almost, I mean, I can imagine it's affected your career in various ways, because you went to Wisconsin, and which is an old area studies, you know, center. And I was wondering how you have experienced the kind of heyday and decline of area studies for our field, and how it influenced your kind of intellectual development, and what aspects of area studies are ones that we should be keeping, and which ones can we just let die?
Right. Well, you know, I still I grew up at a went to grad school at a time when area studies is still quite prominent. Again, it would begin to erode basically at the end of my graduate school period. But you know, when I started, I went to Wisconsin in '77, and don't recall hearing objections to it at that time. Still, I guess I myself sometimes found it limiting. Maybe, like I say, like I came to the study of Eastern Europe out of an interest in American politics, and while I was fascinated by Russian history and by an East European present, as when I set about writing about it, you know, I always had in mind connecting it to other issues of democracy, of political practice. So, you know, I've never seen myself even exclusively as a area studies person. But I always, you know, like I like to say, most of my work, I've always hung my hat on Eastern Europe, by which I mean I can talk about these broader issues, but the way I can empirically defend it, the way I have some concrete argument that's new, is by talking about East European particulars that I know extremely well, right? Mm-hmm. So you know, I always have thought and still think that it's central to know real-world experiences, real-world cases, and that comes above all from, you know, area studies or particular country studies. You know, I think as that started eroding, or interest in that started eroding, you know, it seemed that the alternative, this right behaviorist and again statistical alternative, was just you know, didn't seem to make a lot of sense, especially at the beginning, and you know, a lot of the rational choice theory early on emerging in the 1970s seems, you know, utterly simplistic. You know, I don't think that's the case nowadays, you know, or certainly not necessarily. I think that, again, not being in a graduate school myself, I'm not really in a position to say how much that has eroded, or, yeah, you would, you know, certainly know more than me about how well that's encouraged or discouraged. I mean, because it's not like, you know, any area studies is shunned on now. I mean, people who know the Arab world, right, the Middle East, the Arab world, Afghanistan, Iraq, Central Asia, are, right, have possibilities U.S. academy that...
I mean, that area used to be ours. I mean, the former Soviet Union used to encompass...
Yes,
you know,
yes.
And part of what this is about is... Our area in particular has been, first of all, redefined.
Well, redefined, yes. I was, you know, Soviet and East Europe, right?
Yeah,
so, I mean, for me, actually, it's been intellectually fruitful that things changed so much. I had to become, you know, learn a lot more about Western Europe and about market economies right after I did my first book, again, and right when I was in a position of what do I do now that's new or that's different, right? So, you know, I have been able to expand a lot because the definition of the area changed. You know, of course, now I think, and you probably agree, that, you know, Eastern Europe is sort of too much associated with Western Europe. and its Soviet connections and are you know lost. You know, I tend to teach. It's ironic in some ways. I'm not exactly sure why, but that I haven't taught Eastern Europe myself much at Hobart and William Smith. I do think one of the reasons is that, you know, I know the case so well, and particularly Poland so well, but most of what I know comes from Polish sources that I wouldn't be able to assign. And also, you know, there is, for undergraduates, there's an element of if you know something too well, you know, you say something and you need to qualify it too often, right? And it's not really the case. Where if I know something well, but I'm not the total expert on it, I can present a convincing story and overall case and not, you know, that I think undergraduates need to know, you know? So, I mean, I did know through undergraduate and early graduate, I got to know Soviet history quite well, and I still see myself as knowing that very well. You know, and in recent years, I've come to learn a great deal about, right, post-communist Russia or China, right, that kind of development. I mean, as someone who's been interested in the communist world, right, can still have wide swaths of global interest today, I guess I don't know what it's like for a student or graduate student beginning today. You know, there's not, there's not today a lot of very exciting topics dealing with Eastern Europe.
Contemporary.
Yeah, contemporary. I mean, there are dealing with, you know, immigration, they're dealing with labor markets, dealing with some minority policies in some countries.
Well, maybe this is a good segue to my last question, which is, where are your own intellectual interests headed now?
Well, since my book came out in 2005, The Defeat of Solidarity, I haven't done the kind of ethnographic research in Poland or anywhere else that I did for so many years up till that time. I kind of follow it a bit from time to time, and you know, but things haven't changed dramatically. I think, you know, the book is still stands, I think, largely correct, and you know, since then there are not dramatic developments. I still think that right, class anger and class dissatisfaction has impact on politics. You know, there's not any direct one-to-one correlation because there's no clear, you know, left party that's pro-labor. On the contrary, you have in Poland, I mean, like in Hungary, right, a right-wing party that sometimes makes is the alternative to neoliberalism as well, or at least the discursive alternative, if not the actual one being in power, right? So, you know, lately I wrote this article that Illusory Corporatism in Eastern Europe that came out in 2000, and one of the things I'm working on, I published in the Warsaw Forum of Economic Sociology, but I hope to revise it and expand it for publication here, is about the way instead of East European labor getting stronger in line with development and strengthening of unions, which one might have expected, not that I particularly did, but in any case it was theoretically, or, you know, it was possible. What we see instead is this growing expansion of this more illusory corporatism to Western Europe and elsewhere, right? So you see an expansion of kind of formal inclusion, formal democratic and individualistic inclusion of workers, whether it's teamwork or whether it's, you know, having some individual rights on the job, connected with attempts to erode union power, right, do away with old style with old-style corporatism. So, you know, I've been working a lot. Been working a lot on that. I do want to this article about illusory corporatism 10 years after, right, talks about how developments in Western Europe have mimicked more what happened in Eastern Europe. Also, we've seen an expansion of tripartite forms far afield from Europe, somewhat in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia. There was a book on that called Blunting Neoliberalism that I reviewed, and that, so I definitely am including more global issues, experiences from elsewhere in the world. So one direction is to, right, talk about class issues more generally and more globally, talk about specific developments in labor markets, and I'm still intervening in this debate about corporatism because I think it's completely disappeared, but you have, because there's still some formal inclusion, you have a host of social scientists who try to defend it with various adjectives. You know, it's contemporary corporatism, or it's competitive corporatism, or it's liberal corporatism. I mean, you know, and I think intellectually we need to not see this as any type of corporatism at all, right? But a new type of neoliberalism. I've been very influenced lately by this regulation school of what is it called? Regulationist theory within Marxism, or in the U.S. it's also known as the social structures of accumulation. Came out more of, you know, economic sociologists talking about crises of capitalism without any kind of, you know, Marxist telos, that this ends in working class upheaval, right? So it doesn't deal with that, but it deals with, you know, different ways in which capitalism manages, deals with its own contradictions, and tries to stabilize in new ways. And one of the books I'm reviewing that has really opened up a lot for me, by Frederick Deo in he writes on Asia, sociologist in Binghamton, and his new book talks about neoliberalism as a new type of regulatory mode, right, in which we see an erosion of formal dictatorships, some inclusion of individual labor rights, at the same time trying to erode any kind of traditional union privilege, ways of trying to present precariosity, right, precariousness as an alternative, right, as an alternative to union bureaucracy, a possibility for self-advancement, right, and that's a way of legitimizing, I think, class-based inequalities, but it has a lot of clout, right, because we do see a time in which human rights is celebrated, and, right, we're all Democrats today, and we're all supposed to support human rights, individual rights. Unions are seen as something that are, right, a relic of the past and a burden and heavily bureaucratized. So, so these are more general issues I'm working on. I must say, you know, I do find it one of the challenges I've had, you know, because I've actually published less in the last few years than I have probably in previous times, and that's partly because I'm working on new areas, but it's also partly because as I move away from the focus on Eastern Europe myself, I'm less familiar even on how to write it up. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned a moment ago, I've always written and talked about more general issues, but hanging my hat on the East Europe, and even more particularly the Polish experience, right, which I knew better than almost anyone else, right, I knew intimately, and so I was very confident I could always talk about that reliably. Now when I'm doing more general stuff, which I think I need to do and want to do, but by definition I'm not in a position to know these other cases so well. I don't know all the languages, I know few languages, and now, you know, I mean, I still get by in Russian and Polish and some other Slavic languages occasionally, and you know, maybe read headlines or a little bit in Romance languages, but not much else. You know, so uh, So I find when I write it up, it requires a different kind of prose, right? The kind of prose that, again, social scientists always do, but, you know, historians like yourself or the kind of political scientist I was, right, we didn't write in more general stuff, and we usually, you know, if we read that kind of stuff, we would know how wrong they were on the particular cases. You know, but at the same time, we, you know, learn from that kind of writing. So I'm trying to do more, but I, you know, it's still a struggle to push myself to make claims about these other countries, what's going on there, even being aware that, you know, I can't defend them as well as I could my old claims about Eastern Europe, right? But I'm also not going to be in a position to do so. And if I wait to be able to do so, I won't write anything, right? So, you know, I do think, again, that experience I've had allows me to, I feel confident in talking about these broader issues, and I'm learning more about that, and, you know, have read through a lot of the sociological debates about class that, you know, I'm still no expert on, because, you know, my interest is still coming from the political angle and, you know, the political salience of class conflicts or not, right? I mean, class, even if class conflicts may exist in some kind of objective form or objective sense, they're not common today. Still, people don't think in terms of class for a variety of legitimate reasons, right? Because class became so connected, became so famous, so worldwide a category, because it was associated with male industrial manufacturing labor that was so central to economies for so long in the late 19th to the mid 20th century, right? So nowadays, concepts of class just need to be totally rethought in new ways. So also I'm working on, right, class and culture, because there's some theories that say, oh, class isn't important anymore, culture is. And one of the things I've written up, and again, I've published this only in Polish now, but hope to, you know, write it in English or get it published, something similar here, is the way in which, right, class was so central to Western society precisely because it penetrated into the culture, right? Because class was a category widely understood culturally. You could say the term working class and people knew what you meant, right? Knew what that kind of community was, right? That this was a cultural category. I mean, class is not class, like nation, class is another type of imagined community, right? It made sense. It was compelling. That argument that classes exist had a good base, right? There were people who picked that up and saw that as important, as obvious in their lives. And that's shaken up so much since the 1960s in a variety of ways that, you know, we won't go into. Right? It's shaken that all up with, you know, no longer white manufacturing labor, no longer male labor, no longer just manufacturing labor, right? And so nowadays you can still talk about class existing in various ways, but still that concept of class, in particular working class, is still an outmoded concept, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not that class it's not that culture is important now and class isn't, right? Still think class is essential, but class is not the powerful cultural concept that it was in the past. And I think that's what many people miss, the power of class as a cultural concept once upon a time. And so I do see, like, a revival of interest in class needs to also be done with a rigorous rethinking and re-engagement of what does that mean, right? And talk about the real legitimate ways in which, why, you know, you can't just revive class analysis. You know, when I talk about class, I can defend myself because, you know, my first book, right, class wasn't central to it. So when I talk about it now, some people still kind of imagine I want to go back to some kind of, you know, old style way of thinking. And that's, you know, completely not what I want to do, or I think there's any, you know, there's any reason to do. Right, so that's the kind of issue I guess I'm still grappling with, and and I would like to work on and write on, but, you know.
Well, I look forward to reading it, and thank you so much for this, and, you know, I'm glad that we live in the same town. Maybe we can do it again.
That'd be great. Thank you so much for the invitation. This is a great series you've got.